Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are just as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They're milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Betches Media presents...
Chrissy Teigen referred to Donald Trump as a pussy-ass bitch.
Look, he's a sick puppy. He shouldn't be there.
Well, I lost half a day of skiing.
I'm going to punch him out and I'm going to go to jail. I'm going to be happy.
The Betches Sub-Podcast.
A speaker has not been elected.
Hello, this is the Betches Up Podcast, where C-SPAN meets the group chat to help you process and laugh at the biggest topics in U.S. news and politics. I'm Amanda Duberman, the news director at Betches.
I'm Elise Morales, a comedian and writer of the Betches Up newsletter.
And I'm Millie Tamaris, comedian and sub-video contributor.
Happy Thursday, fam. How we feeling today? How we doing? It's giving fall.
Fall is upon us, yes.
And we're gritting.
I'll admit if people get the vibe that I'm a little sleepy today, I went and saw Millie do a fabulous show last night.
Thank you.
And I shouldn't have had the last drink that I had. Mm-hmm. That's what I'll say, is that I should have stopped and not had the last one that I got while closing out my tab. And I would be in my mental acumen would be higher today.
Thursdays are tricky because I feel like, especially if you live in a city where people drink a lot excessively, it starts on Wednesdays. Usually Wednesday is like Monday, you get through Monday, Tuesday, and then by Wednesday, people are ready to go have cocktails. But this was a big show, right, Millie?
Yeah, it was a big show. It was taped. It's going to be on cracked.com.
Did you publicize this one? Was there tickets available to it?
I did. Okay. Not as much as I probably should have, but there was a good turnout.
Yeah, it was packed house. It was great.
Yeah, I've just been in it was really cool. So I'm excited and that'll be online. But I'm also very tired from that. And then when I got home, I wanted to do some light watching. So I watched the best TV show in the world, The Morning Show.
Everybody is going crazy over the new season. I've got to watch it.
It's insane. It's like Riverdale for 40-year-olds. It's not as fantastical and doesn't take, but like they do go to space in the first. It's just insane.
I heard there's an insurrection storyline in the first episode, right?
They refuse to say Trump and it's weird. It's weird what they decide to talk about. They refuse to say Trump, but they say they keep bringing up presidency, whatever. They bring up the insurrection, but they don't reenact it or you don't see it any. But they made John Hamm play the Elon Musk character, which is so insane.
Because Hamm's too hot.
Exactly. They did last night. They did a racial storyline that was weird, where they got hacked in the second episode. And then they released all the CEO emails, and one of the CEOs referred to a new hire as Aunt Jemima.
Oh my God.
Jennifer Aniston. There was a thing about a referendum about wokeness.
Isn't there a revenge porn storyline too, kind of? Or a leaked video storyline?
Yeah, that is, yeah, exactly.
That's in episode one.
That's what I'm saying. It's just insane. What they decide to cover. It's Riverdale, where it's wow, we're really doing this. Okay, cool.
I've been watching in the past couple of days. I've watched probably 40 episodes of Below Deck. I don't know what's going on. This happens to me every couple of years where it just grips me and then I'll kind of fall off. This is Below Deck Down Under is amazing.
If you watch it, you know. Watching with your phone, because I feel like that's good. You're on your phone and watching, or are you glued?
I'm glued. I'm watching it on my television for days at a time. It just feels good. If you watch it, you know Aisha's the most magical woman that's ever lived. It just feels like you're on a really expensive vacation, all day. I want to spend all day on this yacht with these people, with these gorgeous 25-year-olds who are getting screamed at by new money. It's amazing.
Yeah, I think that Because Danny and I did finally take on Vanderpump, and we are about to finish season six. We have the
Oh my God.
I know we have the reunions.
Girls, we've been productive.
I know reunions, but I think once Vanderpump is done, we've done the same thing where we've like gone on a Below Deck tear and then fallen off. I think we might return to Below Deck.
Below Deck Down Under really got me back in, and now I'm gonna climb. I'm gonna dive back into to all of the rest.
Also, obsessed. I mean, as we're talking Kookalooney, yeah, gotta watch Salt Lake. This they're
I'm catching
they're crazy.
Up.
They're insane. So I love it.
Yeah,
they're insane.
I'm almost caught up to the new season, and then I'm gonna I should be able to like by the time the reunion comes around, I should be like on track with it.
Yeah,
yeah, definitely a good time to prepare your metabolism for binge watching. You know, a range of quality reality TV programs, especially with this writer's strike. Speaking of TV, breaking news, as we just began recording the pod, Rupert Murdoch will step down as chairman of his conservative media empire. The 92-year-old announced today that his oldest son, Lachlan Murdoch, he's 52.
The eldest boy.
The eldest boy it is, will replace him as chair of both his firms, which are Fox Corp and News Corp. So Lachlan was apparently already kind of managing day-to-day operations at both companies. They both had these roles already, but they both had co in them, and now he'll be the only one. So, you know, not much might really change there, but just imagine you have a net worth of $17 billion. What do you do in your first day of retirement? What are you doing? You have all the time in the world and $17 billion.
I mean, I'm doing Below Deck Live.
Yeah.
I'm going on some Below Deck in person and getting somebody to make me scrambled eggs at 2 a.m.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the thing is, I feel like if I had amassed Rupert Murdoch's wealth, I would have retired far earlier so that I wouldn't be 92.
I think it's a rule that on every set podcast we say we would have retired by now.
By 80 I will be retired, but it like to me it's like I feel like you can't take advantage of your full retirement when you're 92, because I do wonder, it's like, I mean, I'm sure he has like a super duper duper yacht that has everything he needs on it, but it's also like, do you want to be in the middle of the ocean when you're 92?
Mm.
You know, if shit goes down, don't you want to be able to be like helicopter? I mean, I'm sure his yacht has a helipad, but I feel like it's like, you know, you got to retire earlier. So with that 17 bill,
you should be, Elise, you should be, you should start a cottage industry where you're like a retirement consultant, where you do tell people, you know, yes, you could wait and make more money, but then you will get to such an advanced age that you cannot be without more than 10 miles away from a hospital.
Yeah.
You can give people their exact, precisely correct, the most like optimize their retirement year.
Yeah. Hire me to tell people they should retire. That's the whole job, is that I'm just like, no, you should retire. You're old.
I mean, you'll be very busy because apparently none of these motherfuckers want to retire.
No.
Not a single one.
Apparently retirement is like the most insane, disgusting thing these people could ever do.
Yeah. I would start a dachshund sanctuary for dachshunds that broke their back, which is like 1 in 5 dachshunds. And I would just have people take care of them on their, and they can drag themselves around and we'll get them all the surgery. This is a pet concern of mine. Every single day, I probably donate to a GoFundMe to get a dachshund back surgery. So I would buy the nicest townhouse in the city and make, actually, I would probably buy the dachshund sanctuary like outside of the city and let somebody else run it. Mm. That would be too sad. And then for me, I'd buy the biggest townhouse.
You'd visit often.
I would visit often, of course. And I'm sure a couple of them I would fall in love with and I would bring back to my massive townhouse.
I'm surprised that you wouldn't like have like a coffee shop with dachshunds in it.
I would. I've thought about doing like what I would love to do is something that's kind of a coffee shop and a dispensary in one.
Mm.
But that would just be so tricky because like, how do you keep the dogs from the, it's gotta be, how do you keep the dogs from the weed? It's too tricky, but the dog cafes pull it off.
If anyone can figure it out, it's you, Amanda.
Thank you.
Not to like bring up this cursed name, but I did watch that Johnny Depp Amber Heard documentary that was on Netflix, and one of the things that
I heard it wasn't good.
No, it's not. Well, it's just stuff you've already seen. It's like reliving something that, why would you want to relive it? But I did watch it, and I will say that one of the revelations is that the dog that supposedly shit in the bed, but that he said she had shit in the bed, that dog has had incontinence problems. I think its name is Boo. And it's had incontinence problems its whole life because one day it ate Johnny Depp's weed when it was a puppy.
Damn.
And that is so sad.
Shit in the bed more, like, it actually has shit in the bed before, and there are, like, texts that are revealed of her being like, boo shit on Johnny in the middle of the night because of his incontinence problems, and it's because the dog ate Johnny Depp's weed. So you definitely do not want to let a dog eat weed, especially if it's a puppy.
Yeah, I'll do a dispensary next to a dog-friendly coffee shop. Yeah. I think that's what I would do with my $17 billion.
Thing where there's a dog. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of people that do not know what to do with their money, that takes us to our numbers segment, which today is 9, because that's how many days Congress has to come up with some way to fund the government, either temporarily or on a long-term basis. We'll get through this quickly because I don't know how many times we've discussed either a shutdown showdown or a debt ceiling showdown in our many years of doing this, probably like 35, and it's always the same thing.
That's a number.
It's every show.
It's every time.
That's a number.
It's yes. Every time it comes up, they're always like, oh, we can't come up with a deal. And it's because one side is playing fucking games with, like, there's no level of responsibility to do the most basic function, which is just like keep the fucking lights on.
And this one is kind of more gratifying because, like, I feel like Kevin McCarthy is ready to kind of like vote for Medicare for all just to get something out of the House of Representatives. So the House of Representatives is, of course, trying to figure out a way to fund the government. That's all every day there's like 4 sets of headlines that are like drama, drama, drama. It changes dramatically every single day. Even temporarily, they're just trying to figure out right now, we got to come up with a way before the end of the month, before this budget deadline, to continue funding the government. They can do that with like a short-term thing where we only can agree to do this for 30 days and then we'll basically procrastinate and put off the spending bill. But, you know, right now, all they are trying to do is come up with their own version of a spending bill or continuing resolution to send to the Senate. They have to send anything to the Senate, anything. Of course, anything they did send as a first offering would be rejected by the Senate. But as of right now, the idea is get them a piece of paper that says something, and they can't do it. They can't agree on anything. The House, Republicans have the House, but they have it narrowly. And there's a handful of Republicans that, like, McCarthy can afford to lose 4 votes. And there are 7 people that are basically like, I don't really know. They want insane things, but it sounds like they're not really interested in passing anything.
No.
They're from a political point of view, they're right about something, which is that they're like, we can't get nothing out of this. We look dumb. We barely got anything with the shutdown, with the debt ceiling. And a shutdown isn't as serious. It's bad because people are furloughed and government functions can kind of be temporarily suspended. It's not like global economic collapse, which is what, you know, a debt ceiling breach would have done. They're trying to stuff these bills with money for crazy things like border security. They're obsessed with border security, but also don't want to send money to Ukraine. So they don't want to protect Ukraine from Russia. They do want to protect Texas from tiny migrant children, apparently.
Yeah.
And there are even like centrist Republicans that are furious at these people. They're all fighting. And it's possible that Kevin McCarthy will have to end up relying on Democratic votes just to get something to the Senate, in which case his colleagues would definitely move to remove him from the speakership. There was like a picture going around yesterday of like an already printed out resolution to vacate the chair.
Yeah.
I was reading
Matt
this
Gaetz
morning.
Left it in a bathroom.
Yeah. Left in a
Matt
bathroom.
Matt Gaetz left a printed out resolution to remove Kevin McCarthy, just like lying around in a bathroom.
Which I wonder if he did that on purpose.
I think he did 100%. I think he was like, see, I'm a petty bitch and I'm going to leave this around as like a little threat. And I'm just like, why does Kevin McCarthy even want to do this job for another day, to be honest?
Yeah.
Like, I know that it was like his dream job, but it's like, you know, sometimes, I don't know, this is something I've worked on in my own therapy, sometimes you have to... your dreams change and you get more information and you realize, oh, this job is actually fucking hell. And it's not what I anticipated. And I would like to move on and have maybe I'll start a dog cafe.
And when most of your colleagues are like, sounds like a good idea. Consider
well, especially
it.
If you had to audition, apply for the job 15 times publicly and people were saying no all the time. And, you know, I mean, as funny and interesting and kind of egg on their face, kind of schadenfreude it is to see Republicans deal with this, I can't get it out of my mind that this is also like Democrats' fault. Not this specifically, but like We could have kept the house if we thought more strategically. There were some safe seats that we were not thinking about the bigger picture. Yeah. It should never come to this. And this
George
is like
George Santos is still in there, y'all.
George Santos is still in there. Like we should have.
Lauren Boebert is there.
Like Miss fucking over the pants hand job at Beetlejuice ass is there. Like, this is a failure on both sides because we're not doing what we're supposed to be doing. And also there, but like, this is what happens when we don't fight aggressively and we get too comfortable. These motherfuckers elect crazy people who, again, like, Kevin McCarthy's always going to be beholden to the craziest person in his party because the craziest person in his party does not care about doing their job. They are not elected officials. They are stunt politicians who want the latest viral moment and all this stuff, and they don't care about getting things done. And that is what we're dealing with here, and that's the state of the Republican Party today. You have Vivek Ramaswamy, who's like, one of the forerunners, not in Congress, but I'm just saying that's an example of the kind of people that the Republican Party is excited to elect. And this guy's like, yeah, I'm going to lay off 75%. You know what I mean? It's like,
right.
And they don't care about actual day-to-day governance.
And it's just so wild to me that, like, I'm reading articles that say Kevin McCarthy might have to rely on Democratic votes. Like, that would be like just to get it out of the House. I mean, the faction, like you're saying, the faction of members that are just completely uncooperative, that are there to stop things from happening. And like, these are people that were boosted by largely Trump, who all of these people supported at various times. And so, yeah, this is exactly kind of what they were asking for. But it is crazy how far they go. Like, Zelensky wanted to do another joint address to Congress, and Kevin McCarthy said no. Like, when Zelensky, like one of the most popular men in the world, ask, and you can't even get, you have beef with him. He doesn't.
Because he doesn't know that fucking Lauren Boebert isn't going to start screaming and vaping and doing her shit. And like they can't even do this. We can't even have a State of the Union without that behavior.
And no. Not to get tinfoil hat, but we're not sure where a lot of these Republican politicians are getting funding and who's funding them.
I wish that were tinfoil hat. Absolutely.
Cough, Russia. So they can't, like, they are putting a line in the sand on the Ukraine shit because that's where a lot of their funding comes from. And that's where a lot of the misinformation and chaos that causes Democrats to stay home, that fuels old people to vote aggressively Republican. A lot of that's coming from Russia. And Kevin McCarthy knows that. And it's crazy that Mr. McCarthy wants anything with Democrats because he refused to fucking impeach Trump. So this is what you get, but also this is what we get.
Yeah, I tend to think of like this. I can't remember if I've used this metaphor on the podcast before, but I feel like the government shutdown negotiations are like planning a bachelorette party with a lot of different factions. Like, it's made up with like the bride's high school friends and her college friends and her work friends she met later in life. Her high school friends are batshit crazy. They probably storm the Capitol, and they're at risk of becoming a Karen meme like everywhere they go. The reasonable friends and the crazy friends, they're like trying to work together on a budget for the party. Mm-hmm. They're trying. Mm-hmm. We're one of the reasonable friends, and we're like willing to negotiate to a certain degree. But the high school friends, they're demanding budget cuts that don't make any sense. I'm like, we're like, look, maybe we don't need to go yachting every single day. But then the crazy high school friends, they're like, we don't need food. We don't need food. Cut the food. Cut the food. We need the yachts, though. The military needs the yachts. We don't care if they lose them. The military needs a lot. And then the leader of the batch, let's say Kevin's like the maid of honor. He's like, okay, I'll take that suggestion. Maybe we don't need food. And then they're like, well, what do we need water for? Let's ditch the water. And then none of you have anything. Everything's crazy. You can't even negotiate. You can't even go on the trip. Everything is a mess.
Well, wow. What a betches reference. Let's clap it up for Amanda on that one.
Much like our bodies, perhaps the government just doesn't need to carry out our necessary functions. We'll see where this goes. If they can pull this party off. But there's going to be some unusual alliances here. And to put a button on this metaphor, I think what usually makes a bachelorette party come together is when you have a reasonable sister. And we just don't here. We do not have a reasonable sister.
Can I say, everything you just said in part three of Legally Blonde, where Elle Woods becomes a political pundit on MSNBC. That whole the government's like a bachelor party speech would be in the movie.
It's yours,
would
be Reese. In the script. It is yours. It's yours. Today's episode of American Fever Dream is brought to you by Nuuly. Have you ever felt that fast fashion ick, but can't always afford the super high-end stuff? I have a solution for you. It's Nuuly. Nuuly has everything you need to bring your closet up to speed for the season without breaking the bank. Free your closet of impulse purchases and skip the buyer's remorse by renting instead. Nuuly is a subscription rental service, and for just $98 a month, you get your choice of any six styles. They also have inclusive sizing up to 5X, as well as petite and maternity. You get fast, free shipping and returns and professional cleaning in Nuuly's state-of-the-art laundering facility. No laundry for you to worry about. This is the best. You just put it back in your box, send it out, and before you know it, you've got your next one. And you always have the option to buy what you love for sometimes up to 75% off. I bought the Rachel Antonoff pasta puffer from them. I was obsessed with it, like everybody who tries it is, and it was completely sold out everywhere else. So I felt like I really, really had an in there. So thank you, Nuuly. Nuuly is an amazing value at $98 a month for any six styles. And right now you can get $20 off your first month of Nuuly when you sign up with the code FEVERDREAM20. Just go to NUULY.com. That's Nuuly with two U's, and enter the code FEVERDREAM20 and sign up to get $20 off your first month. That's NUULY.com, Nuuly with two U's with code FEVERDREAM20. Nuuly subscription clothing rental, change your clothes. All right, let's move on to the main news. We'll just keep watching that. It's going to get down to the wire. For the main news, okay, so I was going to add this story to our show on Monday, but I wasn't sure we had much to say on it. But it turns out a lot of people had a lot of things to say. We're going to talk about the Senate dress code situation. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. So he announced earlier in the week that the staff for the Chamber Sergeant at Arms, basically like the hall monitor for the Senate, will no longer enforce a dress code on the Senate floor. And apparently these staff were pretty intense about it. They would stop senators for not wearing ties. They did change a rule a couple years ago to let Kyrsten Sinema, because she was the first person, I guess, who really liked wearing sleeveless tops. Amy Klobuchar got that rule changed for her. Now Chuck Schumer is saying that senators are free to wear whatever they want. He was like, I'm still going to wear a suit. Senators are free to wear what they choose. Senators historically have gotten around the dress code when casting votes by voting like in an actual doorway. The rule didn't apply if you had one foot in and one foot out. So senators have taken advantage of this rule in the past to cast votes like on their way to the gym or like if they're rushing from a plane and didn't change. So I don't know for certain that John Fetterman has used this tactic more than the other senators, but I feel safe to assume that he has. Apparently he's been doing this quite a lot, especially since he came out of treatment for depression. Before that, he seemed to be wearing like suits that he definitely looked uneasy in, and now has taken, you know, returned to kind of his campaign trail outfit, which is baggy shorts, a hoodie, and sneakers. So he has been wearing that to the Senate. The relaxed rule is only going to apply to senators and not their staffs. Fetterman said that he appreciated the rule change, but he said he planned to only use it sparingly. I think yesterday he presided over the Senate, and I believe he wore shorts with a short sleeve button up. People have had some reactions to this, a lot of overreactions, I think. Kansas Senator Roger Marshall, he called it a sad day in the Senate. Naturally, I had to look up if this man calling it a sad day in the Senate also voted against certifying the election while there was still blood in the Capitol. He did. Of course he did.
Of course he did.
But it's the dress code change that's a sad day for the Senate. Marjorie Taylor Greene, which of course cast the same vote, she called it disgraceful. Ron DeSantis just had an incoherent complaint. He was just like, how can we keep lowering the bar? Susan Collins joked that she planned to wear a bikini to work. Go for it, honestly. The Washington Post editorial board published an op-ed saying that, you know, people should dress up to work in the Senate. Others didn't really care. Yesterday, there were quite a few senators spotted again without their ties. Josh Hawley was wearing, I just saw it described as jeans and boots. I really wanted to look at a picture.
Are they a boot cut? A flare?
Right. I think there's like a few conversations to have here. Like, is the fury over this dress code change justified? And the other question I think we're going to get to in our answers is, should senators dress up?
I mean, first part of the question, From Republicans, I won't hear this because we literally have fucking Tom, like Tuberville or whatever. Like, they were only just able to confirm the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He's holding up 300 military nominations right now because he's mad about abortion policy. Like, you don't get to be playing those kinds of games and then be mad about like dress code level decorum. Like, Marjorie Taylor Greene is one of the people who shouts stuff during the State of the Union. Like, it's just no. And then, yeah, anyone who voted not to certify the election, like, you guys don't take this job seriously in a way that is much more impactful. Personally, I think they're probably, I think some, like, an office type dress code makes sense for the Senate. I personally feel
Marjorie.
No. I know. I'm like, now I'm a Republican.
She's leaving the podcast and now her real views come out.
Yeah, exactly. Where I go all
just
in.
Just kidding. I agree with you.
Yeah, I just think, like, I don't know, like a regular office dress code. If they want to institute a casual Friday, I definitely think, I don't care if they have to wear a tie. I don't care about sleeves or whatever. But I do think some of the, like, I mean, it seems like John Fetterman at least wore a button down the other day, but like shorts and a hoodie, I'm a little like, I've had jobs where I couldn't wear shorts and a hoodie.
Well, it's like, there's a lot of things in the intersection here. And I think, you know, one thing that I keep thinking about is just in general, office clothes and work culture has shifted in this way where people don't wear like office clothes. Like, that's just a general American trend and it's happening kind of all over the world. So I can understand why that's happening in Senate, but also like it is part of the job. Like, you do, it's like both things where it's like, this is a general trend, but also like, this is a specialized job where you do have to dress. And all I can think about when you were breaking down like actual outfits, I'm like, where is Tan France when you need him? He needs to take John Fetterman. Like, there are comfortable things that can make, like, that
this is
are,
what I'm saying. Put him in a linen suit.
Or, like, wear, like, talk to a fashion expert and see, like, what are things that, you know, because it is part of your brand. And I think me and Elise were chatting about this last night of, like, you know, Fetterman wants to have that, like, every man kind of appeal, and that's his brand and whatever. And it's like, I don't know, dude, there are a lot of everyman who still have to dress up for work. Like, if anything, that's more everyman than the privilege of wearing hoodies and shorts. Like, there aren't many jobs you can do that. And it's also like, I don't know, AOC and a lot of other fucking people on the squad and women, they all have stylists. You pay someone a couple thousand dollars once a year to help you like come up with some repeatable outfits to wear to work. And it's just, I don't know. I'm conflicted because on one end, it doesn't matter. And it's like the whatever. And I don't want to hear shit from Republicans. But on the other end, and I'm like, honey, this is part of your job. And like, you got to fucking dress the part and you're representing your fucking people. And you like, could you imagine if a woman was like, I want to wear athleisure every day?
That's my main rejection of it as well, is that like the dress code, like loosening the dress code, fine. I don't think they should have to wear like business casual is fine. Like khakis with a nice belt and a nice shirt. And like, because remember, I remember when we had that discussion a while ago, it was a very slow news week. When like Hakeem Jeffries and Kevin McCarthy wore casual dress shoes. Sneakers. And honestly, a couple people were like, who cares? And I was like, fair. But this is like that, who cares? That's fine. That doesn't matter. You're still dressed up. But like, I think my kind of slight annoyance with this, not accommodation for him, but maybe just the idea that it's just acceptable to wear that to work is because they would never let a woman get away with this. They would say she looks like a slob. They would never let a black man get away with this. No. Absolutely not. And it's clear there's nobody else. And again, does that mean that John Fetterman shouldn't be allowed to wear what he wants? I also like, I personally know people with somebody with pretty extreme like sensory issues and she wears shorts always. She just can't not. She can't function properly if she has fabric touching her legs. That's a totally different situation. And if that's John Fetterman's situation, then I'm fine with it. And maybe he doesn't need to be that transparent. But also, like, I hate wearing pants with buttons too. Like, even but people also, that don't.
Is your
I don't
friend
know.
Gonna like apply for a job no, where she has not. To wear like pants? Probably
no,
not.
But, and then she would wear, you know, she would find like the nicest shorts she could.
Yeah.
And then overcorrect with the nicest top. So it's again, like, I'm conflicted too. And I don't know if this reaction is coming from like resentment for this just creating this permission structure, because like, he's not like, it's not even like he's wearing a very loose hoodie and sagging basketball shorts and sneakers. That looks great if you're going to Target, but like there is part, I don't know. Yeah. Like we're all having a similar sort of, Elise and I were talking about this yesterday. I'm sort of like, dress somewhat nicely for the job that the taxpayers are paying you to have. But I also want to make space for people to like, if that makes them super uncomfortable, is that demand unreasonable? I don't know.
I just feel like, number one, as a senator, I think part of the reason why there should be some kind of a dress code, I think business casual is fine. I don't think you necessarily have to have a tie on or whatever, but like, you are making decisions that are hugely impacting people's lives. And I think mm-hmm. out of respect for that, maybe you don't mm-hmm. need to be in like shorts and a hoodie. But there's something about like, and I like John Fetterman and I like a lot of the things that he had, like, I like a lot of the taboos that he has broken yes. with his candidacy in it. But with this, he's putting out all of this stuff that's like, I dress like a slob. And he made shirts that are like, I dress however mm-hmm. I want and all this stuff. And it's, for me, what it's giving is like, that very like kind of like 90s Gen X dude bro thing of like, I don't give a shit what I look like. And it's actually like, it's a little like, it's fucking gay to like mm-hmm. care what you look like. And obviously that's not what he's saying, but that's kind of the mentality that it's bringing up for me of
he
like,
he doesn't see the value in the in dressing somewhat formally.
Yeah. Of like, it, oh, most I'm people such do. A guy. I'm just an everyman Pennsylvania dude. So I couldn't possibly talk to someone about finding a pair of pants that I like or give a shit about what I'm putting on to go to work. And I'm just like,
yeah.
I don't know. It reminds me of like when you see a dude wearing shorts in the dead of winter and you're like, what are yes. you trying to prove with this? Like, why do you have these shorts on? Like, what what's going on here? Why can't you find, I'm not saying he needs to turn up looking amazing or that fashion needs to be something that he cares about, but it is weird to me to be like, I will only wear shorts and a hoodie.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's like the very extreme version of like, everybody knows we're all going to a restaurant where you need to wear pants. And there's just one guy that's just like, fuck no, I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to. And then he's like, well, it's going to be a scene when we get there. They're going to not let us in. He's like, fine. And the Senate is much more consequential than sort of like a meal. Again, he said he's going to use it sparingly. But yeah, I think we're all kind of having the same feeling, which is just that like, maybe there should be like, maybe you should, you know, spiff yourself up a little bit for a lot of jobs. Like if we have an interview with somebody over Zoom, that's kind of, I make sure to put on a collared shirt and put makeup on. We all do, mm-hmm. even though yeah. we're just sitting our asses like at home and we might not do anything with it. Whenever I have a meeting, honestly, with like anybody in the office, I make sure I like put a little effort into it.
And it's also like you're literally voting on people's rights and like the future of this country. So for me,
that's
it's
too,
more,
yeah. You're being photographed in these monumental moments.
Yeah, for me, it's more respect for the fact that like you're coming into this place to make decisions that are going to affect all of us. And it's like, I don't know, I wouldn't feel great if I saw some dude in shorts and a hoodie being like, abortion, I guess. Like, I'm just like, I don't.
Right.
Like,
and is that worse than these terrible Republicans voting against it? No.
No,
not
what
at
Republicans
all.
Are
but
doing
is
to-
a gravity to their work that, you know, seems like it's not that hard to match with
a button down,
a button.
Khakis.
Well, honestly, I just thought about one time, everything goes back to my dating. One time I was so excited to see this guy had asked me out for like a year. like texting me and all this stuff. And finally, I was like, okay. And I picked out a really nice outfit and I got my hair done. This was definitely like in 2012.
Do you tell this story in your stand-up?
I don't think so.
No, I'm thinking a different one. Sorry.
This happened twice. And this motherfucker's wearing sweatpants. And the first time they wasn't. It was like these black joggers. And he's like, what do you want me to do? Go home and change? And I'm like, yes. Mm-hmm. And we went back to his so he can change. And then the second time I'm like, it's not about the sweatpants or the guy that wears sweatpants to a date. It's about the attitude of the guy of like, this isn't important to him. He didn't put like any thought, like it's just whatever. And I'm just like, I don't even want to go out on a date with a guy with fucking sweatpants, let alone have my student loans, abortion, healthcare, all that shit wrapped up in a guy with sweatpants. Also, I gotta say, I was holding this in, but I'm gonna say it now. Josh Hawley wearing boots and jeans giving Varsity Blues. It's giving the Varsity Blues movie, and it's weird.
Just imagining the image. You're not looking at a photo, are you? Well, we'll definitely have to post a photo if one ever emerges. Have you guys ever been like in a professional environment or a work thing, or even like at a formal event and had somebody say something to you about what you were wearing that made you feel like, oh, I didn't dress up enough?
I was a temp at like a corporate job, and I used to get approached about like my clothes not being work appropriate. In the time I didn't receive it well, cause I didn't feel like that person gave a fuck about me. And she was like trying to do it like as the other black woman in the office. And she was like trying to tell me like, I have to be more polished than everybody. And I can't get away, especially it was a very nuanced thing. It's happened multiple times where like I'm in an office situation, but because I'm bigger and black, like I don't have the same, I can wear the same thing that one of my white counterparts was wearing and not get, you know, but I'm going to be the one that gets in trouble all the time. And my, my response to that is like, you're not paying me enough to do that. But like, also like that has been an adjustment for me where I'm like, I know that like, I don't want to work in these companies where that's a problem. So I don't. And like some of these companies pay really well, but I'm not willing to go to fucking Ann Taylor Loft and spend $300 on business attire. That's my thing. But anyway.
I haven't worked a ton of office jobs, to be honest, because like my thing was always working like childcare jobs until I got into like the comedy world, and like the office I worked at was Betches, which like there is like some decorum at Betches.
Yeah, yes.
Like, but it was never one like it was easy for me to follow. Especially
if big people are coming in, it's kind of like the office used to be a lot more like head to toe athleisure. Now people get dressed every day, but like they used to like, hey, people are coming in. Like they would never say like I like how here we tell people like, you know, be camera ready, whatever that means to you. That just means we might use the video. How you feel good, how you feel, you know, positive in the image of yourself that you're conveying. And I guess that's just bizarre that I wish John Fetterman thought that camera ready meant more than hoodies and shorts.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because that was kind of another thing I was thinking where I was like, I could understand there being maybe like a dress code, a more formal dress code in place for like voting as opposed to like just kind of like regular days. But I guess there's just a lot of voting that you do. So I don't know how you like parse that out. Or whatever. And who knows, maybe John Fetterman will do that on his own. At least it seems like he put a button down on to like preside over the Senate. So it seems like that's in his head a little bit. But I do very specifically remember a friend of mine when I first got to New York who was always like, it's kind of like an admin assistant role or like secretary at the front desk type situation. And I remember she had on like what I would have thought to be like a really cute outfit. She was like a very put together, fashionable person. And it was like a cute, like sweater or whatever. And an older woman, which is, it just, Millie's story reminded me because it was another woman.
Older women.
Yeah. Came up to her and was like, you look like you're in pajamas. And it's like, she was wearing like a really nice like sweater. It was just kind of like a big, like chunky sweater, I guess. But it definitely, it was like a mismatch of sensibilities across generations. Cause to me, I was like, I would not think anything of it. I think this is like a polished and put together outfit, but this woman came up to her and was like, you can't wear that. You look like you're in pajamas. You look like you're sleeping. Like, it was like really kind of nasty about it. And I remember my friend was like, she came home and she was like, what the hell? And I was like, this is a cute outfit that looks very like, I don't know. I think like polished and fashion forward, but yeah, it was like a generational mismatch. And it is interesting that I do feel like there's a lot of like woman on woman crime in that regard.
100%. I think my reaction to this and what we're all sort of saying is that, and like until we're really ready to let women wear whatever they want, then I'm going to have a little bit of a prickly reaction to letting John Fetterman wear whatever. Because like, yes, women in the Senate here wear whatever you want. It's not going to be received well if they're out there with leggings and a sports bra as a top, which is what a lot of women wear just walking around doing their thing. But if you disagree with us, I'd be curious to know. So let us know. Next up today, women's rights and women's wrongs. All right. The last time, I can't remember if we talked about Emma Roberts being rude to a Secret Service agent on the pod or off of the pod, but that is apparently the least of her offenses. So actress Angelica Ross starred alongside Emma Roberts in American Horror Story 1984. And in an Instagram Live this week, Ross shared an anecdote about Roberts being transphobic on set. It involved a situation where the director referred to Emma Roberts and Angelica Ross as ladies, to which Ross says Emma Roberts replied, "Don't you mean lady?" So obviously super transphobic, strongly suggesting or outright suggesting that Angelica Ross is not a woman. Ross said that she didn't report the incident because she just didn't trust that she wouldn't be viewed as difficult. She worried there would be repercussions. And she's just like, I'm at work trying to have a positive professional experience. I don't want that burden as well. But then Ross referred to another incident where Roberts mimicked her voice, speaking in a lower octave, which is also obviously very transphobic. So Ross, Angelica Ross shares this account, and then Rob says that Roberts called her to apologize. And then Angelica Ross tweeted yesterday, "Thank you, Emma Roberts, for calling and apologizing, recognizing your behavior was not that of an ally. I will leave the line open to follow up on your desire to do better and support social justice causes with your platform." So notably, like, not a denial of that really, really damning and transphobic accusation. But like, yeah, Emma Roberts, not a cool gal.
I would say she sucks.
Yeah, she sucks.
I'll go as far as to say she sucks.
And so if you go watch this live, because it's just such bullying. There's no acceptable transphobia. But the just like snickering about it, the self-satisfaction with being transphobic and punching down is so icky.
And it's very much like Emma Roberts is like, as far as like, especially on that set and in that franchise, she is literally like the star. I imagine she's probably like, there are very set hierarchies when you're on a set like that. Like, literally, you receive a call sheet in the morning, and if you're top of the call sheet, that means that you're top of the call sheet. It means you're the biggest person on the set. You're the star. My guess would be that Emma Roberts is top of the call sheet on an American Horror Story set, unless maybe Sarah Paulson is there. This isn't a season I'm familiar with, but she's probably really close to the top of the call sheet. And so it really is like mean girl, a very Scream Queens thing of her to do, to like, because she really is like leveraging her position on that set and in that franchise. You know that her and Ryan Murphy are very, very close. She's a frequent collaborator of his. Angelica Ross was in Pose as right?
Yes.
So it's
not
like she's bottom of the call sheet, but it is like, Emma Roberts knows that she's like leveraging her position. And one detail of the story that I thought was interesting was like, she made the like, "Don't you mean lady" comment kind of after the director was walking away. So it is a very like mean girl thing to do, to like wait until the teacher has their back turned and then say something shitty and put it on Angelica Ross to either have to complain or not, knowing that you know, this is probably a really intense set. They're doing, it's an intense show. Angelica Ross probably just wants to be able to focus on like the job that she has to do, acting, and doesn't want to have to also have this like fucking HR situation that she's dealing with. And Emma Roberts knows all of that when she goes in to say shitty stuff to her co-star.
And, you know, not that this is important or matters at all, but like Angelica, I don't know. I'm just like, this isn't someone who's just transitioned or is like not passing. Like, and even if she wasn't passing, like, it doesn't matter. Like, the purpose and the root, or, you know, because there could be some grace on misgendering someone if you, you know, an adjustment period of you've known them their whole life and then they, you know, they've transitioned and you're, you can struggle. Like, there is that grace and there is that thing, you know, that's allowed. And it doesn't mean that it still doesn't hurt somebody, but, you know, I doubt Emma Roberts, like, this is all to say that Emma Roberts intentionally did this.
Absolutely.
Like, and yeah, was mean and did not, you know, care about it until she was called out publicly. And that's really like the alarming thing to me, is that she was totally fine doing all of this until she got called out and like was kind of a bully on set. And that shit just doesn't fly anymore. If you learn nothing else from Lea Michele, is that people fucking keep that in their hearts and you always remember, you know? And I think this was just at the start of a rant, or, you know, Angelica has been very transparent about stuff that's happened with Ryan Murphy on the sets and all this stuff. And this was like an anecdote, like exemplary, like showing the fact like how challenging it is to be a trans Black woman in this industry, you know? And I think like a lot of the times people say flippantly, oh God, like everyone wants diverse stories. It's so easy. All you have to do, like everyone wants diversity. No one cares about white people. Like people say stupid shit like that all the time. And it's just like, there are things that you don't have to worry. Like there are things you don't have to worry about when you're like a cis white woman. Like you don't have to worry about your gender being attacked or being bullied in the same way by a,
you know, think about like, if I have to respond here and elevate this, am I going to be seen as difficult?
Absolutely. And you know, that's the reality that
this
Angelica
is the type of thing that should
to.
Like be like a scarlet letter on her for her career, but I'm sure we'll see her in many more things where she just plays a super mean bully.
Well, Emma Roberts, you know, she's also like been arrested for domestic violence. She's like doing milk ads. Like she's just unwell.
Dairy milk?
Dairy
right,
milk.
Get out of here.
Dairy
get
milk.
Here.
It's a whole thing on Who Weekly about all the, like, she's like a brand ambassador for dairy milk.
All right. For a palate cleanser, heavily dairy segment. All right. It is Hispanic Heritage Month, which is observed in the United States annually between September 15th and October 15th. That's because a number of Independence Days fall into that period. So it's obviously a time to draw attention to the range of cultures and their positive impact on American society. The same sentiment is important every year, but especially in recent years, it seems to coincide with politicians spewing dispassionate or straight up xenophobic rhetoric about ongoing immigration from Latin America to the United States. I don't know how Eric Adams is celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month, but his goal seems to be to say as many terrible things about migrants that are legally allowed to be in our city as he can. But, you know, as you've both repeated often throughout the years, the issues, concerns, contributions of Latin Americans in the U.S. are so much broader, more dynamic than simply how their family arrived here or whatever like prevailing political narrative there is. So just for like something different, you are both very funny, professionally funny. So I assume you have very funny families. So to close this out today, I was wondering if you could share like some anecdotes that kind of speak to the spirit of your respective families.
Who should go first? What are you thinking?
You can go, Elise.
Well, okay, so the story, as far as, like, funny stories that came to mind, this is, like, family lore for a really long time. But like many Latin American, particularly Caribbean cultures, Cubans love pork. We love pig. We love a pig roast. And when my family first came to the U.S. and they came, so my family, like brief history or whatever, is like right after the revolution, my family was kind of like, they were all based in Havana, like middle class-ish, which existed in Havana at that time. They left, which is like really typical of like the first wave of Cuban immigrants. My dad and his brother were sent ahead first because they only got two visas. They were in Miami for 3 years. Then my grandparents were able to get visas and come over. And then they went to New Jersey because there was like a really high Cuban population there because there was like a lot of embroidery and factory work. And when like my grandpa owned a bodega for a little while, but he also had experience like, he was like a factory. He like worked on the floor as like a manager in a factory or something like prior. All that to say, my family are the Cubans who went to New Jersey, basically. And when everyone had gotten there, it was like really shortly in after like the first wave of my family had arrived. And there was like a street fair. Which they had never, you know, it's like, we have them in New York all the time where like, it's like a little carnival street fair festival or whatever. And there was a game that you could play where like you had to throw a ball at a target. And if you hit the target, there was a little pig, like a live pig, and it went down a slide. And my family was like, oh shit, we're going to play this game. We're going to win this pig and then we're going to eat this pig, basically. Like, we're going to cook this fucking pig. So they spent the entire day trying to win this game that is like rigged by a carny, like, which they don't understand, that nobody speaks English. They finally win. Like, someone finally hits the target. The pig comes down the slide and and then they just won a piggy bank. The pig was not to be.
Oh my God.
The pig was not like, the guy was like, what? No, this is my pig. The pig isn't the prize. This piggy bank is a prize. And my whole family was like, what the fuck? And oh, so that's kind of incredible. That's like my family's big, like, first month in the U.S. confusion story where like my whole family gathered to try to win this pig and they were like, we're going to fucking roast this pig and it's going to rock. And then they were just given a piggy bank.
Oh my God.
That's
delightful.
So funny. That's so funny.
I'd be furious too.
I have like two little short anecdotes. One was just, you know, I grew up Dominican and my family's like very, like you said, funny families. Like
Your parents are immigrants?
Yeah. My parents are immigrants, but they met in New York City. So they were all like out in the Latin, in the disco, salsa, like Latin jazz. That's what they called it, which is like really intense, like live salsa, like scene. So they both met in New York City. But they are both from Dominican Republic and they're immigrants. But yeah, like I always knew like my family is very witty and like it's very like on it, you know, and I just thought that was like my family thing. And then when I went, I would spend a lot of time because from Miami to Dominican Republic is like an hour and a half, 2 hour flight. So we'd spend a lot of our vacations, like spring break, winter break, summer break, always would go to DR and like, it was always like it was like these puzzle pieces of my life, like getting reconnected of like, oh, wow. And one of the moments that I'm like, oh, it's just like a cultural thing, like this wittiness and the sharpness. One time I was at a carnival or like a street fair in Dominican Republic in Santo Domingo. And I was in this like line for a slide, you know, those slides that they give you like a potato sack and you go down or whatever. And ahead of me was this girl who's, you know, like, I feel like more like working class families and stuff, they really dress up to go out, you know? So this little girl, she had to be like 6 or 7 and she had little, like those little old school kind of dress with the puff sleeves. And that was like green. And she had like a little cute green dress and little fluffy socks that were green. And her mom braided her hair and put green ribbons and all this stuff. And she just looked so cute. And the carny was like, yo, avocado, you're next. let's let's go. And I was like, damn, it's the whole country's like this. Like, this is why I'm like this. It's crazy.
Oh, God, you were painting such a picture for this really wholesome moment for this child.
I know. And he's like, yo, avocado, let's keep it moving. And I'm like, damn. Oh my God.
Avocado.
I know. So fucking mean.
And you were like, I'm home.
I'm like, oh, okay. This is how it is. And then another thing about me, you know, is my mom always owned beauty salons. Like, that was my family business. And the clientele was predominantly Black, like African American, Jamaican American, Haitian American women. But then the staff was mostly like Spanish speaking, but from all these different countries, from Ecuador, from Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, or even Argentina, Panama. We had people from all over. And so I would be there a lot, like serving as shampoo girl, but also translator. But that's why I do really well with strangers, because my job for the longest time was like being in meeting people, getting them through whatever. So one day, this story sticks out to me of like when people think of Hispanic people as a monolith or whatever. One day I had a car. And I was like, hey, I'm taking orders for everybody. I'm going to Taco Bell. And I'm saying this all in Spanish. And then I had to go like woman by woman, like by 10 different women. And they're like, okay, what's that thing where it's flat, but it has cheese on it? And I'm like, a quesadilla. They're like, yeah, give me a quesadilla. What's that? And like, that's a taco. What's that? And it's just like,
you're telling me a Crunchwrap Supreme is not an authentic Hispanic dish.
Well, and also there are so many little moments where even in Spanish, the nuances in Spanish from country to country are so different that it would really like fuck up production in the salon. But also just the idea of like speak Mexican and everyone Mexican and like having to explain the concept of a quesadilla to an Ecuadorian person, that was just like a really like anecdote of me. I was like, oh yeah, like there's so many differences in Hispanic culture. And I love that it's celebrated this month. So thank you for letting me share
of
that.
Of course, those were awesome. Those were what a delight. Hey, avocado. I'm never going to forget that.
Avocado, I'm sure she didn't either. Oh my God.
Formative. Very quick housekeeping note. Our company is off on Monday for the Jewish holiday. We're going to do the same thing we did for Labor Day, which is wait until Tuesday to record a fresh episode. So you're going to get your first weekly episode on Tuesday, and your second weekly episode will come as expected on Thursday. And that will, of course, be Million Elise's last episode, and will mark the beginning of our short hiatus. And we'll share more information and more like, you know, end of an era, you know, conversations for that final episode where we will also
Eras Tour.
Oh man, where we will also recap the next GOP debate. But that's our show for today. Until the end of democracy, I'm Amanda Duberman.
I'm Elise Morales.
I'm Millie Tamaris.
And this is the Betches Up Podcast. Bye.
Bye.
The Betches Up Podcast is produced by Amanda Duberman, Sean Kilby, Jorge Morales Pico, and Rebecca Sousmacat. Editing by Rebecca Sousmacat. Social media by Amanda Duberman and Bridget Swartz. Be sure to follow @betches_sup on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And send us your emails at suppod@betches.com. Betches.